Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to Web Sleuth Radio. I am your host, Tricia Griffith, the very stressed out and eagerly awaiting to be involuntarily committed owner of WebSleuth.com, the most respected true crime discussion forum in any universe, in my opinion. Thank you very much. You're going to love our guest today, my friends. Our guest today is retired FBI Special Agent Jeff Reinick. Now, this man has gotten confessions from serial killers, terrorists, bank robbers, but his specialty is child predators. Now, we are very fortunate to have Jeff's wife, Lori, joining us as well. And we'll talk a little bit about, later in the interview, we'll talk about with Lori how this affected their relationship, because you can't be interviewing and chasing these monsters without bringing at least some of it home. Now, there's a book out. You got to get it. There's just no excuse. It is by Jeff Reinick, and it's called In the Name of the Children. Mr. Reinick, thank you so much for joining us today. I do appreciate it. And I'll call you Jeff, okay?
Yes, that's fine, Krista. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Lori, say hello. I'm so glad you're with us as well.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, and Lori, we'll be talking to you in just a little while. But Jeff, you literally have seen the worst of the worst. I want to talk about how you have a normal life. And let me just tell you quickly a brief story. I heard John Douglas speak, and he talked about not telling his daughters never to look at a strange man. Do not smile at them. I mean, talk about, you know, having to reel in your daughters from enjoying life. How did this affect your real life dealing with all of these monsters?
Similarly, I have two sons. And when they were young, it was almost like a double whammy. In the one case in my book, that's name of the chapter is Michael. When Michael was murdered, he was approximately the same age as my son. And so when I came home from that crime scene, which is one that lives with me today, and I wake up with it every morning and I go to bed with it every night, I just remember standing by my son's room for, I don't even recall how long it was, and my sons would be asking me why I'm holding them and hugging them so much. As they got older and they were going to school, they would have to check in with me regularly, and if they did not, I would go crazy. I've had their school buses stopped. I had the local law enforcement come to my house one morning when I wasn't here and clear my house because I couldn't get through to them on the phone. So it just really and in one case, I addressed one of my son's school classes, and we were talking about, children becoming victims. And after I left and went back to the office, I got a call that day, and apparently one of the children in his room was calling because she had been victimized and wanted to report it to me.
I can understand why something so normal as, hey, I can't get a hold of my wife or kids. They may be outside. Maybe they forgot their cell phone. That's what everybody else would think. But you automatically go right to the worst, right to the monsters. And that certainly is understandable. And Lori, I want to bring you in on this. And I know you don't want to get too personal, but you'll find out I'm very nosy and I just like to know everything. So I do apologize. But this has had to have affected your relationship, right? This job of Jeff's?
Definitely. But we're very, very close. He shares everything with the family. I mean, not with the kids, definitely not the horrific details, but we all knew the cases he was working and how difficult they were. And he shared a lot with me, which was very helpful, I think. But I think the difficult part was neither of us realized how the cases were affecting him emotionally, even though he was sharing them. We didn't realize how it was really affecting him emotionally until much later down the road.
And if I may ask, and then we'll get into the meat of your book here, how did you handle that? Was it therapy? Did you have just kind of a moment, Jeff or Lori, where you just went, I can't do this anymore, I'm done? What happened, and how did you get back on the road to normalcy, I guess, if you will?
Well, I wish I could have achieved normalcy. I don't believe that has happened yet. In my case, my health was affected. I had, from years of being active, I needed to have knee replacements. And when I got my one knee replacement, I developed a staph infection. And the doctors suspect, although there's no way of ever knowing, that it might have been caused by my immune system being depressed from the anxiety, the stress, and the trauma. So through the years, these cases have affected me in a way that I don't know that I've ever recovered from them. And one other thing that I guess it keeps it going is that Lori and I are still in contact with many, if not most, of the victims and their families.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, in 2012, a serial killer asked me to come visit him on death row in California and revealed to me the location of six of his victims. Mm-hmm. And I became involved in that case. And so that literally is ongoing as we speak.
So you're having to deal with that too. You would not be human if these events didn't affect you like they have. Can you reveal the name of the serial killer on death row?
Yes, his name is Wesley Sherman Tine. And in 2012, I was trying to help a friend locate victims, and Wesley found out I was doing that and asked me to come visit him. And I went and spent several hours with him. He gave a lot of information, and he was also had a partner named Lauren Herzog, and together they were called the Speed Freak Killers. And right after I interviewed Wesley, when Lauren found out about the interview, he took his own life.
Oh, wow. That's pretty heavy duty too, but you can certainly understand if somebody is a partner with a maniac like that, why they would definitely take their life when the truth was about to spill out. And stress. Let me put on my doctor's hat here. As you know, stress is probably the number one factor in people getting sick. It can cause all kinds of problems. So I don't know. I hope you are able to somehow deal with that stress, because the last thing anybody wants to see a good man and his wonderful wife together undergoing all this stress and getting sick. Do you feel healthy, or do you think it's just not right there yet?
No, I think I've come to terms with things. It will never, ever be gone from me. There are times when we're doing something or we're watching a movie when it will trigger, and I'll see a scene or an event that reminds me of something, and it will set me off. But for the most part, I can tell you I am happy. My wife, Lori, retired on March 31st, and it has been the happiest time of my life for us to spend our days together. And so we're just fine, and we are happy. And because we have this understanding of how it affected us, I think we're able to be more effective in helping others. And I hope that the book will help other law enforcement officers that are dealing with similar situations to realize that they're not abnormal and they should come forward. And if nothing else, they can call me and I'll talk to them.
Well, that is very, very kind of you. And Lori, I think that's wonderful that you two love each other so much. It gives me renewed hope. So I'm glad to hear there's happy couples out there in the world. Lori, you retired. Are you having as much fun as you want, or how are things going?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's been wonderful. I've been retired for a few months, and yes, we're really just enjoying being with each other. We always have. And I know you mentioned before about, what the emotional aspect of it, and, did we have problems? And I just want to say to the listeners that, as Jeff mentioned, this kind of stress can cause, effects to your body. And when Jeff ended up having an infection, his pituitary stopped working right. So he actually was missing some of the hormones like cortisol and testosterone that affect the way you act, and anxiety and depression. And so once we found that out, he was able to get help for that too. And that definitely made a big difference. So, that's another reason we're hoping, other law enforcement or people that go through these type of situations realize that what this kind of stress can do to you, and to make sure that you know, you look into getting checked out and making sure everything is you know, in your body is working right.
Absolutely. Our guests today are retired FBI Special Agent Jeff Reineck and his wonderful wonderful wife, Lori. And we're talking about Jeff's new book. It's called In the Name of the Children. And Jeff, we're going to get to the child predators that you've dealt with here in just a moment. But there's a very famous case that you had a direct hand in solving. And you know all the horrible details, and that is the Yosemite case. Can you just give us a brief overview of that case for the people so they can jog their memories? I know everybody knows about this case. Just kind of give us a quick rundown of what happened.
Sure. In February of 1999, right around Valentine's Day, a mom named Carol Sund and her daughter Julie and their friend from Argentina, Silvina Peloso, were sightseeing at Yosemite National Park. They were staying in El Portal, about 7 miles from the gate, and they suddenly just disappeared, and there was no trace of them. The family was looking for them. It was terrible, because Yosemite is the seat of beauty, and about 3 weeks later, their rental car was found a great distance away. It had been burned, and two of the women were in the car. They were killed before the car was burned, but just the realization that they were dead was a shocker. And then a week after that, Julie's son was located at a different location, and they were working it for 5 months very intensively. And after 5 months, a fourth victim in Yosemite disappeared. Her name was Joey Armstrong. And it was subsequent to Joey's disappearance that I ended up having an opportunity to meet Kerry Stainer, and he decided to share his confession with me.
And Kerry Stainer, now, he also had a very interesting life. His big brother was taken, kidnapped, and was kept by a pedophile for many years. And there was a big famous movie made about him. If you could give us a little background on that. Although, Kerry Stainer did say that he had these horrible fantasies of harming women and children before his brother was kidnapped. So that kidnapping didn't really play a part in, much of a part anyway, into his sick desires. Tell us about his brother.
His it was actually Kerry's younger brother. His name was Stephen Stainer.
Okay. Stephen, that's
and
right.
In 1973, Stephen was walking near his home in Merced, and he was abducted by two pedophiles, one whose name was Kenneth Parnell, and he just disappeared, was gone. There was a massive search for him that did not find him, and he was gone. After 7 years of his disappearance, another little boy was taken, a 7-year-old boy, and again, another search ensued, and no luck. And a couple weeks later, Stephen Stainer, with the newly abducted boy, I think his name was Timothy White, walked into a sheriff's station, I think it was Yreka, up in Northern California. And when Stephen was asked who he was, all he could offer was that his first name was Stephen. And subsequently, mm-hmm. there was a movie made, and the name of the movie was, I think my name is Stephen or something like that. So it was tragic. The world thinks that after Stephen came home, their family lived happily ever after. But in reality, Tricia, these things don't go away. And Stephen, when he did come home, was not the same child that had left. And it was very disruptive to the family.
And was I correct in saying that Kerry Stainer admitted that even before the kidnapping of his younger brother, he had these sick, dark fantasies. That's what I read. Is that correct?
Yes. And I'd like to just take a minute and say that I know that as society, we look on these people as being sick, as being monsters. But in my experience of working these cases, it's usually another tragedy that you're dealing with, because it's been my experience that the majority of these offenders were victims themselves when they were younger.
Right.
And I always look to the age that they were victimized to look at the preferred age of their victims.
So the Stainer household obviously was not a fun, happy-go-lucky, loving household at any point here. Was Carrie Stainer abused?
Carrie, in his confession, revealed to me that when he was 11 years old, he had an uncle that had sexually abused him. And he also said that that contributed to the images and the fantasies that he had, and that played into what his crimes eventually were.
And just to kind of go off track here a bit, not everybody who is sexually abused turns out to be a scary serial killer or even an abuser, correct? But it seems like everybody that is an abuser or a scary serial killer has been abused. Do you think that is a correct statement?
I think it's overwhelmingly correct. And when I was first starting to do this work and I was being trained at the FBI, I was learning under a guy named Roy Hazelwood, and he recommended a book to new investigators that was entitled Without Conscience, written by Dr. Robert Hare. And
yep,
Dr. Hare
believed, well.
I read that book the first time because I wanted to be a better investigator. And then after Michael Lyon's case, I went and I read it again to try and emotionally deal with what I had seen at Michael's crime scene. And Dr. Hare believes that some people are not born with the ability to feel emotion. And I believe in that. And I think when we talk about these people that commit crimes in our society that are so heinous, that there are some of them that don't have the ability to feel emotion. But like you just said, which I agree with, is I said, I think a great majority of them are good people themselves that have had something disastrous happen to them when they were younger, and it affects how they mature and it affects how they develop.
And that's one of my soapbox topics, if you will, is we need to stop creating these criminals and these monsters by making sure parents are ready to have a child, make sure there is no abuse, make sure there's love. And I know that gets a lot of people all riled up, like, oh, they didn't have enough hugs, so they kill people. No, that's not it at all. You have to understand the brain, which I do not. But I do know when a child is deprived of love, affection, food, all kinds of things, it can really mess up that person's head. And that is, you can look at that as a start, like you said, to most people as to why their brain is not firing the same way and why they have these horrible urges. So if there's some way we could just stop all of this, which is almost impossible, we would quit creating these monsters. Now I'll get down off my soapbox, and I want to talk about Carrie Stainer's case for just a little bit, and then we'll talk about Michael's. Now, How did you find out that Carrie Stainer was one of the suspects? Because you interviewed him, and he no red flags. He came out just fine, right?
Well, this is a point in the case that has some controversy associated with it. When this case first started in February of 1999, I was assigned as the case agent. As the case developed steam and was becoming more of a national and international issue, the managers of my office felt that they needed to become involved, and so they gradually started taking more control of the case. And it finally reached a point where they felt it would be better served if they were running the case. So I was removed as the case agent. Shortly after that happened, I felt like I wasn't contributing very much to the effort, and quite frankly, I didn't agree with how they were working the case. So I kind of extricated myself and came back home to my family. We had a personal event happen around this time where several of our dogs had been injured by a car, and my family was really upset. And I just decided that I wanted to be with my family dealing with this, so I stopped going back to the case. And I pretty much had no association with it or knowledge of what was going on. And then 5 months after that, we lost the fourth victim in Yosemite. Her name was Joey Armstrong. Again, I was not part of this case, but a couple of days after Joey's death, they were looking for Carrie Stainer because he had last been determined to be with her. They found him on a Thursday, the day after he killed Joey, and he was interrogated for 5 hours, but provided absolutely no information, and they had no ability to keep him. And on Friday morning, he was released, and then they determined they would start looking for him again because they felt he had issues with Joey Armstrong's case. Again, I had no knowledge of any of this. The following morning, I was called with two other agents and asked to go meet Carrie Stainer at the Laguna del Sol, a nudist colony. And it was from this point on that I spent time with him, and he eventually ended up asking to speak with me privately, and that's how his confession began.
So you were brought back into the case several months later after, and your boss's name at the time was James Maddock. I guess I'm just kind of baffled. Why in the world would they pull you, of all people, off a case and go, I can do this better myself? Do you have any insight into that? Because that's just stunning.
No, I don't know if it would be appropriate for me to be, you know, reflecting on how I felt or what I felt. But when I do know that when Joey disappeared and we were sent down to pick up Carrie Stainer, we were not participating in the case. We were simply a few agents. It was myself, Ken Hitmeyer, and John Bowles. We were free that Saturday morning, and we all were called and asked to head down there. And our job was simply to make contact with him and figure out what the command post wanted with him. And it was from transporting him back to our office for an interview that we had no idea we were going to be a part of that I, you know, began to get to know him. And we were told he was a witness, so we had no reason to be have any piqued interest other than we did not know him. So, of course, our guard was up just for our own security.
Mm-hmm. How did you get the confession out of him? That here you think he's just a witness, and now you find out he's much more than that. Can you give us kind of the abbreviated version of how you were able to pull this from him?
Absolutely. Well, when we picked him up at Laguna del Sol, I offered to give him a ride back to the office so that he could be interviewed by what was ever waiting for him there. It should have been a 45-minute drive, but it turned out to be a 90-minute drive because of lane closures. And during that time, Carrie Stainer and I were just two guys in a car just talking. And he was telling me about Yosemite and things like that. And I was telling him, you know, my wife, Lori, was a fish and wildlife biologist, and we were talking about, you know, the beauty of Yosemite. We talked about camping, just things like that. But during the ride, and you noticed this too, Tricia, I noticed that he looked very similar to a movie character named Billy Jack of the same movie of the name. And I asked him, you know, did you ever see Billy Jack? And he said no. And for the rest of the ride, we just were kind of talking about things. I also talked to him about the work I had done with child's cases. I asked him how his family was dealing with Stephen's loss and what law enforcement could have done to be better for his family. And all this time, though, I was asking him about Billy Jack. As we were pulling into our office compound, he looked at me and he recited verbatim an exact line from the movie. So we both.
He wasn't telling you the truth.
Right. Yeah, it was just a nice moment. And then eventually when we went into the office, because we had no knowledge of the case, we brought in a polygrapher to interview him and do a polygraph test, and we didn't even know what the polygraph was about. And because we had taken him from breakfast and we were all up early, I also ordered out a pizza for us. The pizza and the polygrapher showed up at the same time, and my friend John asked Carrie, you know, the pizza's here, the polygrapher's here, what do you want to do first? And he said, well, let's skip the polygraph, and I want to talk to Jeff alone. And that's mm-hmm. how it, you know, what's kind of funny about this is that I've had a lot of success with confessions, and a lot of times this is how they start out. And so when he asked to speak to me alone, my partner, Ken Hitmeyer, who was the manager at the time in charge, you know, just kind of rolled his eyes and was like, here we go again. So
mm-hmm. he's going to get it. He's going to get the info.
Yeah.
Well, that, so you basically are of the ethic, I guess, that you, like you said, you don't look at them as monsters. You have empathy and you're kind to them. And that might be some of the most kindness they've probably seen in years, if not ever. And so do you think that's what makes them more comfortable confessing to you?
Yes. And there is, you know, I to be totally honest, I, when you talk about the empathy and seeing them as good people, I like to look for everyone's value. And the joke about me in these confessions is that the subject will come out of the confession crying, and so will I, because I feel so bad for what's happened to them. I actually had one instance where I was interviewing a killer, and I asked him, if you could have anything in the world, what would you want? And he said, I would want to be loved, and I would want to have someone to love. And here he had just murdered a 15-year-old boy, and this is what he wanted in his life. So, you know, I don't have a degree in psychology, but it doesn't take a genius to realize this is a really sad thing.
Mm-hmm. Very, it is. It's tragic, and it happens. There are so many people that grow up wanting that same thing. And again, maybe perhaps because of Dr. Harris' book, maybe the people that aren't born with that ability to have some empathy, maybe that's the ones that turn into the criminals. Let's talk a little bit about Michael. You've mentioned Michael's case a couple of times. Obviously, that is a case that affected you greatly. First, I want to remind everybody who we're talking to, retired FBI Special Agent Jeff Reinick. Now, Jeff has a great book out. You've got to get this book, In the Name of the Children. Also joining us today is his wife, Lori, and we'll talk to Lori again here in just a moment. But let's talk about the case, Michael's case. The one that it seems to me just got to you deeply.
Yes, Michael's case. First, I want to stress, Tricia, that you know there's no one case or one victim that's more important. Instead, these cases represent a experience for me that changes me, or that affected me, or that brought me further to that area where I was traumatized. And in Michael's case, he was abducted by a guy named Robert Rhodes. Robert Rhodes, in my opinion, is exactly what Dr. Hare describes. He doesn't have feelings. And he took Michael while he was walking home from school. He took him to a nearby riverbank, and he tortured him and sexually assaulted him for over 12 hours. People near the river described hearing the cries of the boy all night long. And the one of the utility workers for the town of Yuba, or the city of Yuba City, found his remains, and because we were there and we were working with the Yuba City Police Department, a really good police department at the time, the chief was Chief Dosher, and they secured the scene, and because they secured the scene, no one went in there except for six people, and it was people from the Yuba City Police Department and elements of the FBI. I was one of them. And the coroner for Sutter County was there. And we see this boy who's literally been stabbed 62 times and then had his throat slashed. And he's thrown away like a piece of trash. And it was just an unbelievable scene. And yet I was so proud to be working with the people I was with, because we all did our jobs and everybody did what needed to be done, and it resulted in Robert Rhodes being caught. But as I'm standing there, in my heart and emotions, I'm exploding and doing all I can to try and not show it and think logically what needs to be done so we could contribute to each other working the scene.
Let's talk a little bit about Robert Rhodes for a moment, and then I want to get back to something that came from your book that's very compelling. Let's talk about Robert's background. Did he come from an abusive household? If he was born without empathy, like Dr. Hare might say he was, did he come from a loving household and it just didn't make any difference? What do we know about him?
The Yuba City Police Department conducted most of the investigation about Robert Rhodes. I wasn't part of that. And the only thing I learned about him was his history as we were working Michael's case. And he had a history of sexual assault. He had a history of drug use. He had a long history of what we would consider behavior that was kind of off the grid. When he was arrested because he was near the scene at the time Michael's body was located. But later, the Yuba City Police Department brought in a Sacramento County Sheriff detective named Pat Flood to try and interview Robert Rhodes and give him a polygraph examination. And when Robert Rhodes was asked if he killed that boy, his response was, "Where's my truck?" And this is what I would consider to be a learning part for me, because the polygrapher said that that is what they call a tacit admission. When they don't answer the question in a negative and they change the subject or ask something else, it's almost like saying a confession, because he doesn't want to say no. And so I learned from that, and it never was wrong after that. But Robert Rhodes, what really makes him unique, in my opinion, is that while he was being prosecuted for Michael's death, it was learned that 11 years earlier, in 1985, in the Bay Area of San Francisco, he had abducted and murdered a girl and left her on the side of the road after sexually assaulting her. So Robert Rhodes was actually received two death sentences. He's on death row twice now. And even before that, when we were looking at him for Michael, there was a story we were told that was in his criminal history, that he went to a home that was for sale. He waited for the real estate agent, a woman, and when she showed up, he abducted her. And as he was driving her in the car, he looked at her and said, "This is going to be just like the movies, except you're not going to live." And apparently when he said that to her and she realized she had nothing to lose, she opened the door and jumped out and saved herself.
That's
so
amazing.
This is a person. Yeah. And he was living, he was spending a lot of his time on the banks of the Feather River. And there are a lot of people that are indigent or homeless that live in places like this. And so we had to do a lot of interviews with these people. It was really an experience. And he was at these places because he could do his drug use and no one would be aware of it.
You mentioned just a few moments ago about how he kept Michael for 12 hours overnight and tortured him, and people heard the screams of Michael. Did you ever find out why the hell they didn't call the police when they heard this? Obviously, it would have been a horrific type of scream. Any ideas what happened there?
No, I don't. And I think a lot of times, and I'm as guilty as anybody, when we're living and we'll hear a scream come across the way, I think so many times, the great majority of times we hear someone screaming, it's an argument, a domestic problem or whatever. And, you know, it just takes that one call where you were wrong and then everybody gets angry at you. I remember when we came through New Agent class, and we were told, you know, when you're walking down the street and, you know, you've got your credentials and your gun and you're an FBI agent and you see a man and a woman fighting, they told us, don't get involved, stay away, because if you do, you're going to have both of them beating on you. And of course, that doesn't apply to if you see a crime in progress, but they're telling you to use judgment. So I think a lot of times judgment errs on the side of not calling. And I think people in general feel that way. I don't know that that's a bad thing or anyone should feel bad about it. But I was at another case where a family burned the remains of their child in the fireplace during the summer, and people remembered the smell and the smoke coming out of the chimney, but no one reported it. So how do you sentence people to a lifetime of feeling bad when they don't really know what they were experiencing?
That's a very good point. And you actually have really, I've interviewed a lot of FBI agents, and you seem to be the one that really takes things to heart. Now, I'm not saying the others don't, but like with Michael's case, as we talked about earlier, you stood outside your boy's bedroom and you hugged them more, and they're like, "Dad, what's going on?" Did it always affect you this way, or did it eventually evolve to where it went into your heart and soul? And that's how you were able to get a lot of confessions, because of that heartfelt feeling you had when you were talking to these suspects.
When considering, first of all, I would like to say that the people I worked with and FBI agents, contrary to what's in the news now and how the FBI is being portrayed by politicians, we're like this. We feel this way. We all become a part of our cases. We all care. And the public doesn't see us that much. They're seeing me because I wrote a book, and the book wasn't even intended for the public. It was intended for my family. So I want to first say that, you know, we are that way. I don't consider myself to be unique. Number two is, in terms of how did I get this way, when our son Joe was 3.5 years old, our second son Jordan was born, and Joe had been ill. He was gaining weight, and he had a really bad cold. And when we took him to the doctor for our first well baby visit for our son Jordan, we asked him to look at Joe. And I remember the doctor coming in the room with an ashen face, telling us that Joe had a disease known as pediatric nephrotic syndrome. And for the next couple of years, you know, we were back and forth whether Joe would survive. And Lori was the emotionally stronger one of us. And I can tell you that it was that experience with my own son and seeing the other children in the hospitals and the clinics that were going through these diseases that affected me and left me this way.
Is Joe okay now, I hope?
Yes, Joe's okay. But just like most other children, his disease, you know, affected him. And even to this day, it causes, you know, it affects the way he believes or feels about himself. But he just gave us our first grandson last October. He's got a wonderful wife, a great family, a great job. We're very proud of him. My son Jordan is a police officer here in Sacramento County, and we're very proud. He recently married, and we love our new daughter-in-law, and we're waiting for a granddaughter from them, or grandson or daughter from them, I should say.
Our guest today is retired FBI Special Agent Jeff Reinick. Now, he has written a book called In the Name of the Children. And Web Sleuth members, Web Sleuth guests, let's face it, we are addicted to true crime. We don't want to see bad things happen to people. We understand that, but it does, and we read about it. This is a book for you. I want to talk more about the book, but first, Jeff, where can people pick up In the Name of the Children? Is it available online, bookstores? How do we go about buying this?
It's available at Goodreads. It's available at Amazon. It's available at Barnes & Noble. It's around. And I wanted to tell you, since you asked this, that Lori and I have been watching the Amazon reviews, and it kind of makes our day, but some of the victims from the book have written in to Amazon and reviewed the book, and it's really amazing. I mean, we said to each other that even if the book doesn't sell, the fact that it helped the victims is worth the effort. And
exactly.
We gave We gave the book to all of the victims to read before we pursued this to make sure it was okay. And it's been a positive experience. And I originally did this at my wife's request to leave something behind for my children. And then after she looked at it, she thought it might have value to society. And so we decided to pursue whether it would be, worthy of being a book. And apparently it was.
Oh, absolutely. It is definitely worthy. Lori, we have your wife with us. Lori, you convinced him, first of all, to write something. What made you think about that? How did that happen?
Well, Jeff grew up with birth defects, and he's also Jewish, and that is something that he thought he would never become an FBI agent because of that. And our kids never really understood his, didn't know about his beginnings. And I wanted them to learn about who he was as a person when he was younger. And he was beaten up and everything and made fun of because of his birth defects. And he had an operation when he was 10 years old that made him appear normal. And from there on, he decided he had always wanted to be an FBI agent. That's all in the book. And I wanted the kids to understand his beginnings and then also the cases that he worked in. Even though they were aware of them, we were aware of how difficult they were, he put it all down on paper, and it was just especially meaningful to them. They both read, we call it the manuscript. He had originally entitled it An Improbable Life, and it was very cathartic for us as a family, too.
I can only imagine, and how proud you must be. Jeff, congratulations on everything. I'm not done with you yet. I just have to stop and congratulate you because this is truly an amazing story. And the fact that it's also a love story with you two, that's incredible. You don't get all of this wrapped up in true crime books ever. I think it's wonderful that you both have such a great respect and love for each other. So everybody out there, there is hope. You can find somebody like Lori or Jeff that will love you and respect you. It will happen someday, hopefully.
Krista, I've got to tell you, I'm Lori's second husband. I like to think I'm the favorite one, though.
But we've been together 37 years, so.
There you go. So you are the favorite, by far, hands down. You know, we all have those little mistakes in our lives, and we move on. Jeff, let's talk about your book, In the Name of the Children. It is a book that looks back at your life. Obviously, we heard from Lori about your early beginnings and how you became an FBI agent and how you ended up being retired. You're still involved, like you said, with the victims that you have worked with before. Would you say your specialty, if you could call it that, was getting the pedophiles and the child predators off the street, getting them to confess? Was that kind of how you were looked at in the FBI?
Well, yeah, you know, I'm thinking back on it as you're asking that question. I haven't really considered it in terms of a specialty. I think the best way to look at it, Tricia, is that I was successful getting people to talk about themselves. In our society, we envision the hardest statement to be that of an offender who's committed a crime. But it's my opinion that the hardest statement is coming from a victim who has been victimized, because it's my belief that most all, if not every victim, feels that what happened to them reflects their own value and to some degree is their fault. And as unbelievable as that may sound for someone who is so obviously without responsibility, it does happen. And then in some instances, not only does the victim feel those two things, but sometimes they feel a sense of guilt that they survived and someone else did not. So I think people looked at me as being able to talk to people in a way so that they could feel better by talking about what happened. And that's the way I like to consider it. I hate it when people call me an interrogator, because I like to think of myself as an interviewer.
I was going to say interrogator does not sound at all like a label you should wear. Interrogator, you infer that you're kind of mean and you get to the point and, you know, hit them with a rubber hose. Although I know you don't do that, but that's just kind of the feeling you get when you hear the word interrogator. I almost think you become their friend. Maybe, like I said, probably the only friendly person that they've come across in a long time that is caring and seems like they care about them.
I'm not going to give away names, but I will say that there have been people that were accused of terrible things that are now my Facebook friends.
Really?
Yes.
Now, that's fascinating. So you had people in that were accused of horrible things. You believe, I'm assuming you went in believing that they were accused of, or were you just there to find out? You didn't know.
That's, you know, the book, and for some, I guess for me, it's given rise to somewhat of a question or controversy over interviewing techniques. The adopted interview technique for polygraphers and most law enforcement is called the Reed technique. And I'm not that familiar with the technique. I know it has been successful. Some people are very critical of it, but it's based on the belief of guilt. And I don't go into an interview believing guilt. I go into an interview believing that there's an explanation or a story. And that's what I want to know, because like we said before, everyone has a story. Most people, just by statistics, are going to have feelings. And some people just do things because of the circumstances of their life. And they're not only, it's not only a cry for help and not only a heinous thing that they've done, but it doesn't mean that they don't have value. If you go to a homeless person on the street and everybody looks at that person as having no value, well, I would disagree with that, because that person can exist on the street. If someone put me on the street without any resources like that, I don't know how I would do. So I believe everybody has value.
And that is a great way, especially in your profession that you have since retired from, to have that attitude, because then you do treat people like human beings and therefore they have respect for you, and then it all works out for everybody. Did you always have this ability to look at people's values, or was it a learned type of experience?
When you say it was an ability, I don't know. I think it was something the first, you know, I have to go back to the Frankie Proctor case when I worked with a detective named Greg Stewart. And I think working with him for me was an unbelievable experience, an eye opener to see how he worked. And as an example, at the end of his interviews, he would have people do letters of apology. And I think when you look at the letter of apology, which I adopted from him, and you read these letters of apology, they're so revealing. First of all, they'll always tell you something you missed in the interview. But as important is it gives you a window into what they were thinking, what happened when they committed their crime. We had an instance with a girl who fell into a rice silo and died. And her friends who were with her were afraid to tell the truth. So they made up a story that she'd been abducted. And we started this massive search and rescue investigation trying to locate this girl. And eventually she was found, and eventually the truth came out. And I was with a detective who was doing an interview of one of the friends. And she asked him to write a letter of apology, and he wrote a letter saying it could have been him. He felt so bad. He drew a picture of himself hanging from a noose, and we realized that this child needed help, and it broke our hearts. And I think it was from these experiences that you realize that a lot of these people are in pain themselves. And the ones that are most compelling for me are the victims, because they're the ones that have no place to turn. They feel they have no future. It's up to us as society to show them they have value and they do have a future, and it's not their fault.
I God, I am in love with you, Lori. I'm in love with your husband. And I'm in love with you, too, because I know you feel the same way. I'm in love with both of you. That is so true. One of the reasons that I purchased Web Sleuth when it was a really, really small forum was I felt there were so many people in society that society had forgotten, that they didn't think they had any value, any worth. And I was here to tell them, we wanted you on Web Sleuth to come and talk about true crime. Maybe you'll come up with some great ideas that nobody else has, that they are worth something. Everybody on Web Sleuth is the same, whether you're a four-star general or you're a shut-in that can't get out of the house. And so I totally agree with you 1,000%, and I think we all should be married, but that's just me. Anyway, the three of us,
well,
if you wouldn't mind.
Trisha,
we'll put that on the back burner.
I want you to know that Lori and I are available to you even after this podcast for anything we can do to help with Web Sleuth and to, you know, I agree with you. I think a lot of people want to learn about true crime because they want to understand why people do what they do. And mm-hmm. it's important that if they start realizing that some people do what they do because of the pain they're in, then they can become the origin of help. And, you know, I've seen in my time, in fact, consider Wesley Shermantine, I've been helping a victim family, and the mom of the girl that he murdered has gone to visit him, has spoken with him. They have, he's even, you know, hugged her. She's 4'10" and a dynamo. And Wesley, who's a huge guy, you know, is just so relieved and happy that she would even talk to him, even if she was telling him how angry she was at him. And mm-hmm. I do believe that, you know, we as humans, we need this social interaction and we need to feel a sense of value and acceptance.
Absolutely. And I admire that mother that was able to forgive that man that that killed her daughter. That is an amazing story. Is that in the book too?
No, that is part of the Wesley Shermantine. And there's been some interest in that, but I don't feel that that's my story to tell. If
mm-hmm.
I think if the there are a lot of victim families that need to tell their story to hopefully get their closure. And if those people want to tell their story, I'd be more than happy to join in and tell mine along with theirs. But I barely worked that case at all. I don't feel as if I have the right to talk about this case when it's had so much impact to these families. And mm-hmm. The reason I ended up helping this one woman with her daughter was because I felt she was mistreated by the sheriff of the county she lived in. And I'm proud to say that because of her efforts and our efforts together, that sheriff was elected out of office and a new sheriff is coming in that I have very high hopes for.
That is good news. And that's a whole other podcast that could go on for weeks and weeks. And that is individual police departments, sheriff's departments, and how they do deal with victims and witnesses and such. Some are good, some are not so good, some are really bad. It just all depends on where you land. Jeff, what would you give as advice to somebody, let's say with young children, as a former FBI agent that has actually cracked open cases that involve pedophiles, even ritual sexual abuse, horrible things that innocent children have just somehow were part of, where they were grabbed, they were taken to. What would you tell somebody how to protect their child?
I would tell them that oversight, communication, interaction is paramount. And even more than that, always reassuring the love and how they're cherished. Lori and I and my friend Chris Hopkins and others, we tried to do a startup company to help parents recognize when their children were endangered from their activities on the internet. And we came up with a prototype that worked. Everything was a go. It was a remarkable thing. And one of the tenets of it was to help parents realize that if they see the word your, Y-O-U-R, in their child's correspondence a lot, they need to look very closely because that could be someone asking their child for a lot of personal information. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not a businessman, you know, FBI. Unfortunately, our startup never really started up. but the theory worked, and I had a lot of contact with computer programmers who believed that putting these philosophies into the computer programming could help, which I think it did. But, you know, society gives a lot of lip service because everybody says, oh, yeah, the Internet is so dangerous and is a threat to children, but no one really follows through with it. Parents, for the most part, look at it as a babysitter, just like my generation looked at TV. You know, it's possible in our society for a child from his own home to spend the night in a stranger's house by virtue of the computer and a virtual visit.
Absolutely. It's terrifying. And you wouldn't even know about it because you're in the next room asleep and the kid's got FaceChat or FaceTime, whatever the hell it's called, and there you go. It is terrifying, but you're right. Communication and knowing that kids are loved can prevent, I think, a lot of heartache. Lori, I want to go to you for some final thoughts. Do you have any final thoughts or anything you want to say?
I think the cases that Jeff worked, the emotional aspect was definitely, you know, he worked a lot of them, I think, which is really unusual. There were other agents that worked with him but had decided that they couldn't do that kind of work. And so I am very proud of him for what he has done, the victims he has helped. And as he said, we stayed in contact with a number of victims, and we've gone to some of their weddings, their graduations, and I'm just really proud of the work he has done and the people he has helped.
And Lori, I bet I could say this for Jeff, that he couldn't have done it without you and your help and your kind, loving ways. What a great couple. Jeff Reinick, the name of the book is called In the Name of the Children, Web Sleuth members, guests, and everybody, your friends, neighbors, you got to get this book. I'm going to put some links on Web Sleuth to where you can purchase it, but it is definitely one to put on your list that you need to get as soon as possible, In the Name of the Children. Jeff and Lori Reinick, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tricia.
Thank you.
Okay, my friends, that's it for this edition of Web Sleuth Radio. Now, you can go check us out on Twitter, at Web Sleuth, very easy to find. Facebook, Web Sleuth, once again. I'm not on Instagram yet. When I say I mean Web Sleuth. Why? Because I don't have anything to take pictures of. I'm not going to take pictures of myself. No, I won't do that to you. But everybody has interesting things and fun little things. I sit at a desk. I could take a picture of my reptile mister that I have. Also, my hotshot wasp and hornet net or hornet spray. Let's see. All my pills and drugs that I need to take to breathe and function normally. And, oh, this is really beautiful. Caladryl, topical analgesic skin protector. I guess I could take pictures of that. Anyway, as soon as I have interesting things to take pictures of, I will join Instagram. Don't hold your breath. You will die. Okay, my darling true crime angels, be safe. We'll talk to you next time. Trisha saying so long. Bye-bye.